Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do first half of Chapter 2 of Mein Kampf. Chapter 2 has been divided by translator Thomas Dalton, from whose edition we're working, of course, into 20 subsections, and these are his division. And I think they're very useful. They're not something Hitler put in, though, just to make that point. We're going to do two, it's long enough, about 40 pages, we need to divide it into two sections. So we're going to do the first section today, which is more about his continual growth. Now, he's going to Vienna, his parents have both died, he's in his teens, he's not going to be a civil servant as his father wanted. He loves geography and history, he's become very good at drawing and painting. And now he's going to go to Vienna and see what life has in store for him, and we'll hear more about his personal upbuilding in education, in the ways of the world, on the street, and elsewhere, in sections 2.1 to 2.12. And then next time we'll do the 2.13 to 2.20, which are more about politics. So today we'll do basically pages 58, chapter 2, Years of Study and Suffering in Vienna, 58 to 71 today. So let's get to it. Let's see. As I said, I'm working off of a PDF I don't have, which you can find online. And I'll have an obstacle, or I'll have a link in the permanent thread on the forum. And if you ever have any other problems finding my stuff, you can go to alexlinder.com. I own most of the Alex Linders out there, the main ones. So eventually I'll probably have a permanent archive there as well, for audio and other things. So, okay. Chapter 2 begins on page 56, actually. So I'll do about 15 pages and, as I said, 12 subsections. Chapter 2, Years of Study and Suffering in Vienna. Remember, he came from Braunau, then he went to Realschule at Linz, and now his parents have died, and now he's going to go to Vienna. We left it last time with his mother dying. Now he says, chapter 2 begins, and remember, he's dictating this from prison. When my mother died, my fate had already been decided, at least in one respect. During the last months of her illness, I went to Vienna to take the entrance exam for the Academy of Fine Arts. Armed with a pile of drawings, I was sure that I would pass the examination quite easily. At the Realschule, I was by far the best student in the drawing class, and since that time, I made exceptional progress in the practice of drawing. I was therefore quite pleased with myself and was proud and happy at the prospect of what I considered to be a sure success. But there was one misgiving. It seemed to me that I was better qualified for drawing than for painting, especially in the various branches of architectural drawing. At the same time, my interest in architecture was constantly growing, and I advanced more quickly in this direction after my first visit to Vienna, which lasted 2 weeks. I was not yet 16 years old. Just imagine this, how cosseted people are today. But like his father, he's a bold, intrepid setting out. He's going to make his way in the world. He's 15 years old, and he's got maybe a pack of some of his art, and he's going to see what he can do. I went to the Court Museum to study the paintings in the art gallery there, but the building itself captured almost all my interest, and from early morning until late at night, I spent all my time visiting the various public buildings. And it was always the buildings themselves that were the main attraction for me. I stood for hours in wonderment at the opera and the parliament. The whole Ringstrasse had a magic effect on me, as if it were a scene from 1001 Nights. So again, he's a little kid going to a big city for the first time, one supposes. Section 2.1, Skill as an Architect. Pardon me. And now here I was, for the second time in this beautiful city, impatiently waiting to hear the result of the entrance exam, but confident of success. I was so convinced that when the news came that I had failed, it struck me like a bolt from the blue. Yet that's what happened. I went to see the rector and asked him why they refused to accept me as a student in the General School of Painting, which was part of the academy. He said that my sketches unquestionably showed that painting was not what I was suited for, but rather that they gave clear indications of my aptitude for architectural design. Therefore, the place for me was the School of Architecture, which also formed part of the academy. At first, it was impossible to understand this, seeing that I had never been to an architectural school and had never received any instruction in architectural design. I was quite dejected when I left Hansen Palace on Schillerplatz. I felt at odds with myself for the first time in my young life. Those words came like a lightning flash, one that revealed a long-standing conflict within myself. But until this point, I couldn't give a clear account of it. Well, again, all he's ever had is someone telling him not to go into this field generally, and he hasn't had anyone who knows more about this area point out to him and kind of lead and guide and help him. And now this person has made it clear to him he's better suited for drawing architectural stuff. Within a few days, I myself also realized that I would become an architect. And again, he's 15, maybe 16. But of course, the path was long and very difficult. Or just, he says, the path was very difficult. I now bitterly regretted my former conduct in neglecting and despising certain subjects at the Realschule. Before taking up courses at the School of Architecture, it was necessary to attend the Technical Building School. But this in turn required a graduation certificate from high school, and I simply didn't have this. The fulfillment of my artistic dream seemed impossible. After my mother's death, I came to Vienna for the third time. This visit was destined to last several years. Having been there before, I quickly recovered my old calm and determination. My former self-assurance came back, and I fixed my eyes steadily on the goal. So I guess he went back to Linz or wherever he was in between. And now he's coming back for the third time, ready to go. I would be an architect. Obstacles are placed in our path in life not to defeat us, but to be surmounted. Maybe you want to keep that in your mind as you go through your life. Obstacles are placed in our path in life not to defeat us, but to be surmounted, overcome it. What does the army say? Adapt, improvise, overcome. And I was fully determined to surmount these obstacles, constantly holding the picture of my father in my mind, he who raised himself up by his own efforts to the position of civil servant, even though he was the poor son of a village shoemaker. I had a better start, and my odds of success were better. At that time, my lot in life seemed to me a harsh one, but today I see in it the wise workings of Providence. The goddess of fate took me in her arms and often threatened to smash me, but my will grew stronger as the obstacles increased, and in the end, my will was triumphant. I'm thankful for that period of my life because it hardened me and enabled me to be as tough as I am now, and even more so because I appreciate the fact that I was thereby saved from an empty life of ease and that a mother's darling was taken from her tender arms and handed over to adversity as a new mother. Though I fought against it as too hard a fate, I'm grateful that I was thrust into a world of misery and poverty, and thus came to know the people for whom I was later to fight. 2.2, Formation of a Worldview. It was during this time that my eyes were opened to two dangers, the names of which I had scarcely known before. I had no idea whatsoever of their terrible significance for the existence of the German people. These two dangers were Marxism and Jewry. For many people, the name of Vienna signifies innocent pleasure, a festive place for happy people. For me, unfortunately, it's a living memory of the saddest period in my life. Even today, the mention of that city arouses in me only gloomy thoughts. 5 years of poverty in that Phoenician town, or Phoenician town, one, a reference to Homer's Odyssey, Book 6. Phaeacia, or Sharia, was an island of legendary happiness where residents preferred the pursuit of pleasure to hard work. Phaeacia, I don't remember that from the Odyssey. Anyway, 5 years in which I had to earn my daily bread, first as a casual laborer, and then as a painter of little trifles. and a meager morsel it was indeed, insufficient to calm my constant hunger. That hunger was my faithful guardian, one that never left me and took part in everything I did. Every book that I bought meant renewed hunger, and every visit to the opera meant the intrusion of that inhospitable companion in the days to follow. I was always struggling with my unsympathetic friend. Even so, it was during that time that I learned more than ever before. Apart from my architectural studies and rare visits to the opera, for which I had to go hungry, I had no other pleasure in life except my books. I read a great deal then, and I thought deeply about what I read. All my free time after work was devoted exclusively to study. Thus, within a few years, I was able to acquire a stock of knowledge that I find useful even to this day. I'm to 60. But even more than that, during those years, a view of life and a definite worldview took shape in my mind. These became the granite foundation of my conduct at that time. Since then, I have extended that foundation only very little, and I have changed nothing in it. On the contrary, I am firmly convinced today that, generally speaking, it is in youth that men lay the essential groundwork of their creative thought, wherever that creative thought exists. I distinguish between the wisdom of age, which can arise only from the greater profundity and foresight that are based on the experiences of a long life, and the creative genius of youth. The latter blossoms out in thoughts and ideas with inexhaustible fertility, without being immediately useful because of their very exuberance. These ideas furnish the building materials and plans for the future, and it is from them that age takes the stones and constructs the building, unless the so-called wisdom of age smothers the creative genius of youth. 2.3 Removal of Petty Bourgeois Blinders. The life that I previously led at home with my parents differed little from that of everybody else. I looked forward to the next day without worry, and there was no such thing as a social problem to be faced. Those with whom I passed my younger days belonged to the small bourgeois class. It was therefore a world that had very little contact with the world of genuine manual laborers. For, though at first this may appear surprising, the gulf that separates that class, which is by no means economically well off, from the manual laboring class, is often deeper than people think, from the petty bourgeois, the civil servant, and the laborers. The reason for this division, which we may almost call enmity, lies in the fear that dominates a social group that has risen only slightly above the level of manual labor, a fear that it may fall back into its old condition. Barbara Ehrenreich had a book, Fear of Falling, the middle class fear, or at least be again classed with the laborers. So they're very anxious to move up the social ladder, and they're fearful of falling back, the middle class. Moreover, there is something repulsive in remembering the cultural indigence of the lower class and their rough manners with one another. Those who are only on the first rung of the social ladder find it unbearable to be forced into contact with the cultural level and standard of living from which they have risen. Consequently, the higher classes feel less constraint in their dealings with the lowest class of men than would be possible for the upstarts. For by the word upstart, I mean everyone who has raised himself through his own efforts to a social higher level, to a social level higher than that to which he formerly belonged. Ultimately, this struggle, which is often hard, destroys all sympathy. Our own fight for existence kills our feeling for the misery of those who have been left behind. From this point of view, fate was kind to me. Circumstances forced me to return to that world of poverty and economic insecurity that my father had raised himself from in his early days. The blinders of a narrow, petty bourgeois education were torn from my eyes. Now, for the first time, Vienna, when he's working, I learned to know men, and I learned to distinguish between empty appearances or brutal manners and the real inner nature of the person. So he's seeing essentials and separating them from externals, which is the real masculine job and masculine thinking. The feminine runs entirely by externals. That's why they say women like a man in a suit, because it's a formal known, recognized, which to woman means safety, a symbol of class or value or something that's socially acknowledged to be valuable. 2.4, Vienna's social conflicts. At the beginning of the century, Vienna was, socially speaking, one of the most backward cities in Europe. Dazzling riches and loathsome poverty were intermingled in violent contrast. In the center and inner city, one felt the pulse of an empire of 52 million, one with all the perilous charms of a state of multiple nationalities. The dazzling splendor of the court acted like a magnet on the wealth and intelligence of the whole empire, and this attraction was further strengthened by the centralizing power of the Habsburg monarchy. This centralizing policy was necessary in order to hold together that hodgepodge of mixed nationalities. But as a result, there was an extraordinary concentration of high officials in the city, which served as both a metropolis and the imperial residence. But Vienna was not merely the political and intellectual center of the Danube monarchy. It was also the commercial center. Besides the large group of ranking military officers, state officials, artists and scientists, there was the still larger mass of workers. Abject poverty confronted the wealth of the aristocracy and the merchant class face to face. Thousands of unemployed loitered in front of the palaces on the Ringstrasse, and beneath this Via Triumphalis of old Austria, the homeless huddled together in the murk and filth of the canals. There was hardly any other German city in which the social question could be studied better than in Vienna. But here I must warn against the illusion that this problem can be studied from the top down, studied in apostrophes. The man who has never been in the clutches of that crushing viper can never know what its poison is. An attempt to study it in any other way will result only in superficial talk and sentimental delusions. Both are harmful. The first because it can never go to the root of the question, the second because it completely evades the question. I don't know which is worse, to ignore social distress, as do the majority of those who have been favored by fortune and those who have risen in the social scale through their own routine labor, or the equally arrogant and often tactlessness displayed by people who make a fad of being charitable and who claim to feel for the people, end quotes. In any case, such people sin more than they imagine. Such people sin more than they can imagine. Consequently, and to their own astonishment, they find that the apostrophe social conscience on which they pride themselves never produces any results. Rather, it often causes resentment. And then they talk of the ingratitude of the people. Such people are slow to learn that there is no place for merely social activities and that there can be no expectation of gratitude. Here there's no question of distributing favors, it's essentially a matter of restoring justice. I was protected against the temptation to study the social question this way for the simple reason that I was forced to live in poverty. Therefore, it was not a question of studying the problem objectively, but rather one of testing its effects on me. Though the guinea pig survived the experiment, this is not evidence that it was harmless. When I try today to recall the succession of impressions I received at that time, I find that I can only do so approximately. That means his mind is blanked out from being very, very tough. Harrowing. Here I will describe only the more essential impressions and those that personally affected me the most. And I will mention a few lessons that I learned from this experience. Section 2.5, The Laborer. At that time, it was generally not very difficult to find a job because I sought work not as a skilled tradesman, but as a so-called laborer, ready to take any job that turned up by chance, just for the sake of earning my daily bread. Thus I found myself in the same situation as all those emigrants who'd shake the dust of Europe from their feet and, with iron determination, lay the foundations of a new existence in the new world and earn for themselves a new home. Liberated from all the paralyzing prejudices of class and position environment, and tradition, they take any service that opens its doors to them, accepting any work that comes their way, and filled more and more with the idea that honest work never disgraced anyone, no matter what it may be. And so I was resolved to leap into this new world with both feet, fighting my way ahead. I soon found out that some kind of work was always available, but I also learned that it could be just as quickly and easily be lost. The uncertainty of earning my daily livelihood soon became the darkest feature of this new life. The skilled worker was not so frequently thrown into the streets as the unskilled worker, yet the former was by no means protected against the same fate. Though he may not have to face unemployment due to a lack of demand, the lockout and the strike had the same effect. Here, the element of insecurity in earning one's daily bread was the bitterest aspect of the whole social economic system itself. The element of insecurity. So you never know when you're going to, there won't be a job, or the job you have ends and you get kicked in the street. The country boy who migrates to the big city is attracted by what has been described as easy work, which it actually may be, and fewer working hours. Now, I guess working on a farm. He is especially dazzled by the glimmer of the big cities. Accustomed to earning a steady wage, he has been taught not to quit his former job until a new one is at least in sight. As there is a great scarcity of agricultural labor, the chance of long unemployment in the country is very small. It's a mistake to presume that the boy who leaves the countryside for the city is less solid than those who stay at home to work on the land. On the contrary, experience shows that those who are healthier and more vigorous emigrate, and not the reverse. Among these people, I include not merely those who emigrate to America, like a lot of our ancestors, but also the young rural farmhand who leaves his native village and migrates to the big city where he will be a stranger. He is ready to take the risk of an uncertain fate. Typically, he comes to town with little money in his pocket. For the first few days, he is not discouraged if he is not lucky enough to find work. But if he finds a job and then soon loses it, the situation is much worse. To find new work, especially in winter, is often difficult and indeed sometimes impossible. 2.6. Fate of the worker. For the first few weeks, life is still bearable. He receives his unemployment money from his trade union and thus is able to carry on. But when the last of his own money is gone and his union stops paying due to prolonged unemployment, then comes a real distress. He now walks the streets, hungry. Often he pawns or sells the last of his belongings. His clothes become shabby. And with the increasing poverty of his outward appearance, he descends to a lower social level. Mixing with a class of people that poison his mind, in addition to his physical suffering. He then has nowhere to sleep, and if that happens in winter, which is very often the case, he is in dire straits. Finally, he gets work. But the old story repeats itself. For a second time, the same thing happens. Then a third time. By now, probably much worse. Little by little, he becomes indifferent to this permanent insecurity. Finally, he gets used to the repetition. Thus, even a man who is normally hardworking grows careless in his whole attitude toward life. Gradually, he becomes a tool in the hands of unscrupulous people who exploit him for the sake of their own advantage. He has been so frequently unemployed, through no fault of his own, that he now doesn't care if the strike in which he joins is for securing his economic rights or aimed at the destruction of the state, the social order, or even culture in general. He dislikes going on strike, yet he joins it anyway out of sheer indifference. I saw this process occur before my eyes thousands of times, and the longer I observed it, the more I came to hate that mammoth city, that greedily attracts men to its heart in order to mercilessly crush them in the end. When they arrived, they still belonged to their own people. If they stayed, that tie was broken. I too was so thrown about by life in the metropolis that I experienced the workings of this fate myself, and I felt its effects on my own soul. One thing stood out clearly before my eyes. It was the sudden changes from work to idleness and vice versa that mattered. The constant fluctuations in earnings and spending finally destroyed the sense of thrift for many people, and also the habit of controlling spending in an intelligent way. One's body gradually adapts to eating well in good times and going hungry in bad. Indeed, hunger destroys one's sense of normal spending in good times when one is again employed. The reason for this is that the suffering that the unemployed worker has to endure must be psychologically compensated for by a persistent mental mirage in which he imagines himself eating well once again. And this dream turns into such an obsession that it becomes a morbid impulse to toss off all self-restraint when work and wages come again. Therefore, the moment new work is found, he loses control and begins spending like there's no tomorrow. This upsets even the small weekly budget because spending becomes irrational. When such a thing first happens, earnings will last for perhaps 5 days instead of seven. Later on, they last for only 3 days. If the habit persists, earnings will last for scarcely 1 day, and finally they will disappear in the night. Often there are wife and children at home, and in many cases it happens that they too are affected by such a way of life, especially if the husband is good to them and wants to do the best he can for them and loves them in his own way. Then the week's earnings are spent within 2 or 3 days. The family eats and drinks together as long as the money lasts, but at the end of the week they go hungry. Then the wife wanders around the neighborhood, borrows a little, and runs up small debts with the shopkeepers in an effort to reach the end of the week. Their midday meal is meager and often non-existent. They wait for the coming payday, talking and making plans, and while they are hungry, they dream of the happiness to come. And so the little children become acquainted with misery early in their lives. But the evil culminates when the husband goes his own way from the beginning and the wife protests simply out of love for the children. Then there are quarrels and bad feelings. The husband starts to drink and becomes estranged from the wife. He now gets drunk every Saturday. Fighting for her own existence and that of the children, the wife nags him from factory to tavern in order to get a few pennies from him on payday. Then when he finally comes home, maybe on Sunday or even Monday, having spent his last cent, pathetic scenes follow, ones that cry out for God's mercy. I have actually experienced this hundreds of times. At first I was disgusted and indignant. Later I came to recognize the whole tragedy of their misfortune and to understand the profound causes of it, the deep ones. They were the unhappy victims of bad conditions. Housing conditions were very bad at that time. Viennese manual laborers lived in appalling misery. Even today, I shudder to think of the miserable dens in which people lived, the night shelters and the slums, and all the sordid scenes of garbage, repulsive filth, and worse. Just imagine what will happen one day when masses of freed slaves come forth from these dens of misery, swooping down on their unsuspecting fellow men. For this other world is indeed unsuspecting. They have mindlessly allowed these things to go on without caring and even without suspecting that, sooner or later, destiny will take its vengeance, unless it is appeased in time. Today I earnestly thank Providence for having sent me to such a school. There, I couldn't refuse to take an interest in matters that did not please me, like he had at the Real Schulen Linz. This school soon taught me a profound lesson. In order not to despair completely of the people with whom I lived, I had to separate the outward appearances of their lives from the reasons why they developed that way. Then I could bear everything without discouragement. Those who emerge from all this misfortune and misery, from this filth and outward degradation, were not human beings as such, but rather the deplorable results of deplorable laws. In my own life, similar hardships prevented me from giving way to a pitying sentimentality at the sight of these degraded products of this process of development. No, this is not the way to understand these things. "2.7. the path to improvement. Even in those days, I already saw that there was a twofold method by which alone conditions could be improved, a twofold method for improving things. First, create better fundamental conditions of social development by establishing a profound feeling for social responsibilities. Second, combine this feeling with a ruthless determination to prune away all incurable tumors. Just as nature focuses her greatest attention not on the maintenance of what already exists, but on the selective breeding of offspring, so it is in human life. Life is less a matter of artificially improving the existing generation, which, owing to human characteristics, is impossible 99% of the time, and more a matter of securing from the very start a better road for future development. During my struggle for existence in Vienna, I clearly perceived that the aim of all social activity must never be merely charitable relief, which is ridiculous and useless. Rather, it must be a means of finding a way to eliminate the fundamental deficiencies in our economic and cultural life, deficiencies that necessarily bring about the degradation of the individual, or at least lead him towards such degradation. The difficulty of employing every means, even the most drastic, against those who endanger the state is largely due to an attitude of uncertainty in deciding upon the inner motives and causes of this contemporary phenomenon. This uncertainty is grounded exclusively in the sense of guilt that each individual feels for having permitted this tragedy of degradation. That feeling paralyzes every effort at making a firm decision to act. Because they vacillate, these people are timid and half-hearted in putting into effect even the measures that are indispensable for self-preservation. When the individual is no longer burdened by his own sense of guilt, then and only then will he have that inner strength and outer force to ruthlessly cut out the parasite growth and to root out the weeds. But because the Austrian state had almost no sense of social rights or social legislation, its inability to combat these evil tumors was obvious. 2.8, lack of national pride. Lack of national pride. I don't know what appalled me more at that time. The economic misery of those who were then my companions, their crude customs and morals, or the low level of their intellectual development. Our bourgeoisie often rise up in moral indignation upon hearing from the mouth of some pitiable tramp that it is all the same to him whether he be a German or not, and that he will find himself at home wherever he can get enough to keep himself together. They protest sternly against such a lack of, quote, national pride, and strongly express their horror at such sentiments. But how many people really ask themselves why it is that their own sentiments are better? How many of them understand that their natural pride in being members of a favored nation arises from the many occasions they have encountered that remind them of the greatness of the fatherland and of the nation in all spheres of artistic and cultural life? How many of them realize that pride in the fatherland is largely dependent on knowledge of its greatness in all those spheres? Do our bourgeois circles ever think what a ridiculously meager share the people have in that knowledge that is a necessary prerequisite for the feeling of pride in one's fatherland? It cannot be objected here that in other countries similar conditions exist, and that nevertheless the working classes in those countries have remained patriotic. Even if that were so, it would be no excuse for our negligent attitude. But it is not so. What we call chauvinistic education, in the case of the French people, for example, is only the extreme emphasis on the greatness of France in all spheres of culture, or, as the French say, civilization. The French boy is not educated on purely objective principles. Wherever the importance of the political and cultural greatness of his country is concerned, he is taught in the most subjective way that one can imagine. This education must always be confined to general ideas in a large perspective. These ought to be deeply engraved by constant repetition, if necessary, on the memories and feelings of the people. In our case, however, we are not merely guilty of negative sins of omission, but also of positively perverting the small bit of knowledge that some were fortunate to learn at school. The rats that poison our body politic devour from the hearts and memories of the broad masses even the little bit remaining from distress and misery. 2.9. The Ordeal of the Worker's Child. The Ordeal of the Worker's Child. Imagine the following scene. There is a cellar apartment, and this lodging consists of two damp rooms. A workman and his family live in these rooms, seven people in all. Let's assume that one of the children is a three-year-old boy. That is the age at which children first become conscious of the impressions that they receive. In the case of highly gifted people, traces of these early impressions survive until old age. Now, the narrowness and congestion of these living quarters, seven people in two rooms, are not conducive to pleasant family relations. Quarrels and fits of mutual anger thus arise. These people can hardly be said to live with one another, but rather on top of one another. Small misunderstandings, ones that would disappear in a spacious family home, become here the source of chronic disputes. As far as the children are concerned, the situation is tolerable from one point of view. In such conditions, they are constantly quarreling with one another, but the quarrels are quickly and entirely forgotten. But when the parents endlessly squabble, the daily arguments sink to an unimaginably low level. Such experiences must eventually have an effect on the children. One must actually live through such an environment to truly picture the results of these mutual recriminations, as when the father physically assaults the mother and abuses her in a fit of drunken rage. At the age of six, the child can no longer ignore these sordid details, ones that even an adult would find revolting. Infected with moral poison, bodily undernourished and a head full of lice, the young, quote, citizen, goes to elementary school. With difficulty, he barely learns to read and write. There is no possibility of learning any lessons at home. On the contrary, the father and mother themselves speak ill of the teacher in school in front of the children, and they are far more inclined to insult the teacher than to put their child across the knee and knock sound reason into him. What the child hears at home only decreases his respect for his fellow citizens. Nothing good is said of human nature as a whole, and every institution, from the school to the government, is reviled. Whether they speak of religion and morals or the state and the social order, it's all the same. Everything is disparaged. When the young boy leaves elementary school at the age of 14, it would be difficult to say what are the most striking features of his character. Incredible ignorance insofar as real knowledge is concerned, or cynical impudence combined with a negative attitude toward morality. For one of such a young age, it's enough to make your hair stand on end. 2.10. Young Despiser of Authority. What station in life can such a person fill to whom nothing is sacred and who has never experienced anything noble? On the contrary, who has been intimately acquainted with the lowest kind of human existence. This three-year-old child has become a 15-year-old despiser of authority. He has been acquainted only with the moral filth and vileness and everything excluded that might stimulate his thought toward higher things. And now this young man enters the school of life. He leads the same kind of life that was exemplified for him by his father during childhood. He hangs around street corners and comes home at all hours. He occasionally even beats his poor mother. He curses God and the world and finally ends up in a juvenile correction center. And there he gets his final polish. And his bourgeois contemporaries are astonished at the lack of patriotic enthusiasm that this young citizen displays. Day after day, they are witnesses to the phenomenon of spreading poison among the people through the use of theater and cinema, gutter journalism and obscene books, and yet they are astonished at the deplorable moral standards and national indifference of the masses. As if trash cinema, gutter press, and the like could impart knowledge of the greatness of one's country, quite apart from the earlier education of the individual. I then came to understand, quickly and thoroughly, what I had never been aware of before. It was the following. The question of nationalizing, in quotes, a people, the question of nationalizing a people is first and foremost one of establishing healthy social conditions that will furnish the grounds necessary for the education of the individual. For only when family upbringing and school education have imparted to the individual cultural and economic knowledge, and above all, a sense of the political greatness of his own country, only then will it be possible for him to feel proud of being a citizen. I can only fight for something that I love. I can only love what I respect. And in order to respect something, I must at least have some knowledge of it. Architect and watercolor painter. As soon as my interest in social questions was awakened, I began to study them in a fundamental way. A new and previously unknown world was thus revealed to me. In the years 1909 to 1910, I had so improved my position that I no longer had to earn my daily bread as a manual laborer. I was now working independently as a draftsman and painter in watercolors. This career was a poor one indeed, at least as far as earnings were concerned. I barely had enough to meet the necessities of life, yet it was interesting for me in light of the profession that I aspired to. Moreover, when I came home in the evenings, I was now no longer dead tired as before, when I was unable to glance at a book without falling asleep almost immediately. My present work was therefore aligned with my future profession. Furthermore, I was a master of my own time, and could distribute my working hours better now than before. I painted to make a living, and I studied for pleasure. Thus, I was able to acquire theoretical knowledge of the social problem, something that was a necessary complement to what I was learning through daily experience. I studied all the books I could find that dealt with this question, and I thought deeply about what I read. And I believe that those around me considered me an eccentric person. Apart from my interest in the social question, I naturally devoted myself, with enthusiasm, to the study of architecture. Alongside music, I considered it the queen of the arts, architecture and music. It was pleasure, not work, to study it. I could read or draw until late at night without ever getting tired, and I became more and more confident that my dream of a brilliant future would become true, even though I might have to wait years to achieve it. I was firmly convinced that one day I would make a name for myself as an architect. The fact that, alongside my professional studies, I took the greatest interest in everything political did not seem to be especially important. On the contrary, I looked upon this practical interest in politics as the obvious duty of every thinking man. Those who have no understanding of the political world around them have no right to complain or criticize. I therefore continued to read and study politics extensively. Finally, 212. This will be the last we'll do in this section. The Art of Reading, 212. Reading, however, had a different meaning for me than it has for the average run of our so-called intellectuals. I know people who read endlessly, book after book, from cover to cover, and yet I would not call them well-read. Of course, they know an immense amount, but their brain seems incapable of sifting and organizing the information they have acquired. They don't have the ability to distinguish between what is useful and what is useless. They may retain the former in their minds, and if possible, skip over the latter while reading it, and if that's not possible, they will throw it overboard as useless ballast. Reading is not an end in itself, but a means to an end. Its chief purpose is to help towards filling in the framework that comprises each person's talents and abilities. Thus, each one acquires for himself the tools and materials needed for the fulfillment of his life's work, regardless whether this is the elementary task of earning one's daily bread or a calling that responds to higher human aspirations. Such is the first purpose of reading, and the second purpose is to provide an overall worldview. In both cases, however, the information acquired through reading must not be stored up in the memory corresponding to the successive chapters of the book. Rather, each little piece of knowledge thus gained must be treated as if it were a stone to be inserted into a mosaic so that it finds its proper place among all the other elements that form a general worldview in the reader's mind. Otherwise, only a confused jumble of chaotic notions will result from all this reading. The jumble is not merely useless, but it also tends to make the unfortunate possessor of it conceited. He seriously thinks himself to be well-educated, that he understands something of life. He believes that he has acquired knowledge, whereas the truth is that every increase in such knowledge draws him further away from real life, until finally he ends up either in some sanatorium or in Parliament. Such a person never succeeds in making practical use of his knowledge when the moment calls for it. His mental equipment is not organized to meet the demands of everyday life. His knowledge is stored in his brain as a literal transcript of the books he has read, and in the order in which he has read them. And if fate should one day call upon him to use his book knowledge, it will have to give him title and page number. Otherwise, he will never be able to recall the needed information. But if the page is not mentioned at the critical moment, the bright boy will find himself in a state of hopeless embarrassment. Highly agitated, he searches for comparable cases, and it is almost certain that he will finally deliver the wrong prescription. If that's an incorrect description, then how can we explain the political achievements of our parliamentary heroes who hold the highest positions in government? Otherwise, we would have to attribute their actions to malice and chicanery rather than to pathology. On the one hand, one who has cultivated the art of reading will instantly perceive, in a book or journal or pamphlet, what should be remembered, either because it meets one's needs or it has value in general. What he thus learns is incorporated into his mental picture of a problem or a thing, further correcting or enlarging it so that it becomes more exact and precise. If some practical problem suddenly demands examination or solution, memory will immediately select the appropriate information from the mass that has been acquired through years of reading. Memory will also place this information at the service of one's power of judgment, so as to get a new and clearer view of the problem in question, or to produce a definitive solution. Only thus can reading have any meaning or purpose. For example, a speaker who does not have at hand the sources of information that are necessary to a proper treatment of his subject is unable to defend his opinions against an opponent, even though those opinions may be perfectly solid and true. In every discussion, his memory will abandon him. He cannot summon up arguments to support his statements or to refute his opponent. As long as the speaker only has to defend himself, the situation is not serious. But the evil comes when fate places such a know-it-all, who in reality knows nothing, in charge of a state. From my earliest youth, says Hitler, I tried to read books in the right way, and I was fortunate to have a good memory and intelligence to assist me. From that point of view, my time in Vienna was particularly useful and profitable. My experiences of everyday life there were a constant stimulus to study the most varied problems in new ways. Inasmuch as I was in a position to put theory to the test of reality, and reality to the test of theory, I was protected from the danger of pedantic theorizing on one hand, and on the other, from being too impressed by superficial aspects of reality. The experience of life at that time forced me to make a fundamental theoretical study of the two most important questions, apart from the social question. It is impossible to say when I might have begun to make a thorough study of the doctrine and characteristics of Marxism, were it not for the fact that I ran headfirst into the problem. And that's where we're going to leave it today. We've done 212 out of 220. And we'll cut off where it becomes much more political. I think that'll make more sense by itself. Anyway, I've been Alex Linder, reading to you out of Thomas Dalton's translation of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. We've done the first part of Chapter 2. Thanks for being with me. And always, you can find everything we record at viennainform.com. And I'll be back with you again real soon.